from a horse point of view, what we want them to eat and what they're evolved to eat is the stalky stiff stuff. And the value of the stalky stiff stuff is twofold. One is it requires more chewing. More chewing equals more saliva, equals more natural buffering and protection in the stomach. Two is that stalky hay forms a better basketball. It forms a better roughage ball in the stomach and has physical protection. So it's the structure of the hay, and we're talking about long stem hay here. So we're talking about hay that's, you know, 2 or 3 inches long at least. We don't know the magic number, but 2 or 3 inches long at least, not short stem fiber like cubes and pellets.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Corbion's Alga Prime DHA P3, the algae-based omega-3 DHA to boost brain cognition, immune system, and well-being. Adding it to pet food is easier than ever. Biorigin, your partner in yeast ingredients for palatability, immunity, and nutrition. Complete solutions for every pet diet. Learn about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/pet. That's schooler.com/pet. Young Generation Oral and Gut Health Solutions with antibodies from egg yolk. IGY Technology. Research-driven. Pet-approved.
Hello and welcome to another equine-focused episode of the Pet Food Science Podcast, where we dive into the science, innovation, and research behind how we feed our companion animals, including horses. I'm your host today, Dr. Alex Rankovich, and I'm really excited to get the chance to sit down and speak to Dr. Ben Sykes, who is a leading expert on gastric ulcers in horses. So Dr. Sykes is a veterinarian boarded with the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine, and he's also the director of a BW Sykes consultancy. Welcome, Dr. Ben.
Thank you, Alex. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So before we dive into the gut-wrenching topic of ulcers, I'm going to allow you to start by letting our listeners know a bit more about who you are and your journey into equine medicine and research.
Yeah. So I've been an equine vet for 27 years now. And I did some basic, you know, did my initial work in Australia, then went to the US, did my postgraduate training in internal medicine. And then from there, actually went to work in Finland, of all sort of unusual places, and spent 6.5 years in Finland. And while there, I was working predominantly with a sports horse population. And we really started to recognize the challenges of particularly glandular gastric disease. You know, ulcers had been around for sort of 10 years. We had a pretty good grasp on squamous, but we started to recognize the challenges of glandular and particularly the challenges of non-healing. So when I went back to Australia 15 years ago, I sort of switched a little bit and started doing a lot more clinical research. And my PhD focused on omeprazole and why it maybe works or doesn't work. And then sort of the last 10 years have been a continuation of that, looking further and further into gastric disease with a particular focus on glandular disease. And then probably more recently, sort of stepping back into a bigger picture about the welfare implications of gastric disease and then pain in general in horses.
Perfect. Yeah, I think for anyone who's even remotely spent a bit of time with horses, ulcers is, I think it's just an unavoidable topic, right? It's a huge issue when it comes to welfare of our horses. And so I'm hoping we can kind of dissect that a bit more today. And we'll start by maybe, could you explain to the listeners what exactly equine gastric ulcer syndrome is and why it's such a welfare concern for our horses?
Yeah, so when we talk about equine gastric ulcer syndrome, it's really important that right from the get-go, we split it into two separate sort of disease states. So we have equine squamous gastric disease, and this is the one that we've sort of known about for 25 years. It's the one that, until relatively recently, if you jumped on Google and put ulcers, everything you're going to get is about squamous disease. And it really comes down to the horse's stomach has two parts. It's a single chamber, but the top half of the chamber is lined by a squamous mucosa, and that's like our skin or like our esophagus. And squamous disease is effectively an acid burn on that squamous mucosa. So it's like acid burn in our skin or acid burn in our esophagus, which would be heartburn in people. And then for glandular disease, it's the bottom half of the stomach, and that's much more analogous to peptic ulcer disease or ulcers in humans. And it's really important that we separate those because the causes, the underlying causes, the treatment and the prevention and to some degree the impact of the disease is very different between the two. So we move very quickly away from EGIS to talking about squamous disease or glandular disease. But regardless, both of them have really potential significant welfare impacts for horses. They are potential causes of pain. We have evidence to support that. And they're potential causes of poor performance. And that, you know, they're probably the most common medical disease of the horse, except maybe arthritis in terms of impact or in terms of prevalence. And then impact obviously varies from horse to horse.
So that's I like how you sort of led into where I was going to go next, where you discuss how common it is. So do we know what the prevalence of both squamous and then glandular disease? I know it's kind of a topic that's been more discussed recently, but do we know the prevalence of both of those individually?
Yeah, it varies from population to population. Squamous disease really is associated with, it is a management associated disease. So the more intensive management when I say intensive management, I think about reduction in roughage intake, increase in carbohydrate intake, and increase in exercise duration particularly. The more we have of that, the higher the prevalence. And so the prevalence will vary from, in a really well-managed sports horse population, it'll be less than 50%. In a racehorse population without specific intervention, it'll be as high as 100%. And then, you know, every other horse sort of sits somewhere in the middle depending on its environment, and particularly on those factors, particularly around roughage availability, less about carbohydrates these days, unless we're talking about really high performance horses. Glandular is less well studied, but the thing about glandular is it's not that direct association between that really high performance horse and that really hard working, high energy diet, low roughage diet. Glandular is not associated primarily with diet. We don't see epidemiologically, we don't see associations between diet and glandular disease. What we see is more stress-based factors and more individual-based factors. So I sort of think of squamous as being 80% environment, 20% horse, and I think of glandular as being 80% horse and 20% environment. So we know, for example, the warm blood breed is predisposed. One of the single biggest risk factors for having glandular disease is being a warm blood breed horse. And we see it much more in our show jumping and our dressage and our pleasure horse populations. And in terms of prevalence, in terms of horses that are actively sort of out and about competing, training, we're probably talking in the 50 to 75% range. So, you know, both are really common in our horses that are used for our recreational purposes and used for our competition. And I say competition, not necessarily in the terms of high end competition. I'm talking more about sort of recreational competition even with those prevalences.
You mentioned sport horses again and again. I know that's where a lot of the research is, but I always wonder about weanlings, because that is a very, like, I think a lot of those risk factors do come up during that period of their life. And so with those guys, are they also at risk? Do we know the prevalence there? Is it glandular? Is it squamous?
It's potentially both. And again, squamous, if we want to look at squamous and we want to look at a horse or look at a population and we say, what's the risk of squamous disease? We really have to ask, the first question is, what's the roughage? What's happening with roughage in those horses? And it's availability of roughage and it's consumption of roughage. So weanlings is a really good example where they may have roughage available, but if they're behaviorally stressed or there's herd competition, then they may actually not be consuming the roughage. It's no good sitting in the paddock. It needs to be inside the horse and the horses need to be accessing too. So those factors about roughage availability are going to be particularly important in weanlings. And we do see squamous disease. For want of a better term, they tend to grow out of it as they sort of adapt to their new life being weaned. And as long as environmental conditions are good, the good thing about squamous disease is it'll self-heal if they maintain their roughage intake or take their roughage intake back. Glandular disease, same. It's a stress-based disease. We see it in weaning populations. There's a couple of studies, but they're not terribly well reported in those populations. There was a lot of work done when squamous disease first hit the scene 25 years ago. That same body of work hasn't been done for glandular disease. But we do recognize it, and it really loops back to this whole idea, particularly when we're talking about glandular disease, about thinking about it as we think about squamous disease as a diet roughage disease, we think about glandular disease as a behavioral stress welfare disease.
In terms of diet, now you've brought up a couple times in roughage, what exactly does that look like? Is it just making sure, you know, our horse has hay in front of them? Is it more nuanced than that? Is it the type of hay, the volume? Kind of what are we talking about?
Yeah, it's a combination of all of the above. So when we're talking about hay consumption for squamous disease, the way I think about it is I think about the stomach having basically a big soccer ball inside of it, or a football inside of it, that, or a basketball inside of it, depending on which sport you're into.
Which part of the world you're in too, I guess.
Yeah, it depends which part of the world you're in. But the this idea that there's a basketball-sized wad of hay sitting inside the stomach. And what that does is it does a couple of things. One is it physically stops the acid from splashing up onto the squamous mucosa. So it literally just sits there and holds the acid down in the bottom part of the stomach. The other is it acts as a buffer and soaks up the acid. And the third is the chewing of the hay creates saliva, and the saliva has bicarbonate, and it effectively just constantly pushes that acid down back to where it belongs in the bottom half of the stomach. So we've sort of got this tide effect where the stomach's producing acid and it wants to come up, and as we eat hay, it's constantly pushing saliva in, which is pushing it back down. We want that tide to be as low as possible. And so it comes down to how much hay you eat, and we sort of aim for 2% body weight per day in terms of dry matter, in terms of our actual intake. And it's one of the first things I do when I have a horse with unexplained squamous disease is actually get the owner to measure the hay intake, because ad libitum hay is our recommendation, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're eating it. Right. And so we do have horses that, for behavioral reasons, maybe for dental reasons, maybe for because they've got squamous disease and it's causing discomfort, aren't eating the amount of hay they need to eat to maintain that normal protective mechanism. The second thing is the type of hay. And when we think about the type of hay, we intuitively, when we think about hay, and I'm not talking about alfalfa versus grass hay at this stage, I'm talking about the actual physical structure of hay. Our inclination is we sort of like this soft, tender looking hay. It sort of appeals to us. That's the stuff that we'd want to eat, right? But from a horse point of view, what we want them to eat and what they're evolved to eat is the stalky, stiff stuff. And the value of the stalky, stiff stuff is twofold. One is it requires more chewing. More chewing equals more saliva, equals more natural buffering and protection in the stomach. Two is that stalky hay forms a better basketball. It forms a better roughage ball in the stomach and has physical protection. So It's the structure of the hay, and we're talking about long stem hay here. So we're talking about hay that's, 2 or 3 inches long at least. We don't know the magic number, but 2 or 3 inches long at least, not short stem fiber like cubes and pellets. And then the last one is the, alfalfa versus grass hay. And alfalfa has some benefits. The buffering effects of alfalfa are potentially useful, but in my mind, they're not overridden by the other things. It's the quantity right. And the chewing. And then the last thing about hay is the timing. We want it in there when the horse does its highest risk activities. And the highest risk activities from a squamous point of view are exercise and transport. And both exercise and transport are high risk activities because what they do effectively is lift the acid up and push the acid up onto the squamous mucosa. So before exercise and before transport, we want to make sure we optimize that natural protection that we get from feeding hay. And that's where we'll use something like pre-exercise feeding with alfalfa hay as one of our routine strategies. So we've talked about ad lib hay for a long time and it's the cornerstone, but it gets a little more nuanced than that when we start making sure that they're still getting the appropriate quantity, that the type of roughage they're getting is suitable to encourage chewing, and that the timing of roughage is there when we really need it most for optimal protection.
That's perfect. I think you're absolutely right. We always talk about ad lib hay and free choice hay when it comes to ulcers, but I think the timing in particular, and to your point, absolutely, the length of that hay too that's being provided is I think often overlooked. So I wanted to touch a little bit more on feeding pre-exercise. So in terms of volume, how much do you often recommend in those situations? Or is it right before feeding? Is there a magic number?
Yeah, so we think of, as I said, I think about this stomach having a tide, the tide's going up and down, the acid's going up and down, and that's really dynamic. It's a very dynamic state. The stomach's continually producing acid. It produces more during feeding, but it's continually producing acid. So it's constantly wanting to rise, and we want to be constantly pushing it down. So in terms of timing, we want to do that as close to exercise as possible. So I'll be doing that basically while the horse is being tacked up. Now, there's other benefits to that as well when we think about the behavioral interactions and we think about stress management and those sorts of things. So we want the horse during tacking up, basically. And we have this very anthropomorphic idea about eating before exercise. You know, mum said you can't eat, you can't swim within an hour of having food. That's not the way it works for horses. Horses have this massive spleen that is designed to contract during exercise. That is what makes the horse, one of the things that makes the horse the phenomenal athlete that it is this spleen that holds about a third of its red blood cell capacity that it contracts during exercise. And that's what we want. That's what when we get that pain when we're swimming, that's your spleen contracting saying, hey, but that's actually what we want horses to do. So we have to remove that anthropomorphism of saying food before exercise is bad. What we need is buffering that stomach and optimizing protection before exercise. In terms of amount, it's not really studied, but you know, probably as little as a pound makes a difference. When we think about, you know, hay, we always think about a biscuit or a flake of hay. A good size alfalfa flake or biscuit of hay is going to have a very significant impact on pushing that gastric acidity down for the duration of exercise.
And I know you just mentioned alfalfa now, pre-exercise, and you've also previously mentioned the kind of the buffering capacity of alfalfa. Could you dissect that a little bit more? I'm not sure that all our listeners maybe know why alfalfa is discussed in that manner and what it is about alfalfa that is considered, you know, maybe the better option in terms of buffering in some of these situations.
Yeah, and I think it's a good question because, you know, alfalfa has its own natural buffering capacity. In addition to what it stimulates from the horse, it has the ability to soak up acid itself and act as a buffer. But we've got to balance that with those other factors around like chewing, and stem and stuff like that. And palatability. You know, if we've got a horse that prefers grass hay, then the fact that it's going to eat it and it's going to get a quantity in is going to be more important than the other. So, Absolutely. And that's been distorted a little bit in the sense that we see the popularity of alfalfa pellets and cubes being, you know, let's give these pre-exercise because the alfalfa will buffer the acid. Yes, the alfalfa can buffer the acid to some degree, but in my opinion, the majority of the buffering, the majority of the benefits is going to come from our chewing and from the fiber length and the natural saliva. Mm-hmm. And we know that horses chewing hay, whether it be grass hay or alfalfa hay or any type of hay, are going to chew 3 to 4 times as much than if they're chewing pellets or cubes. So yes, there's protective benefits of alfalfa directly, but we have to put them in the context of the bigger picture. And it ultimately comes down to palatability and amount. And I'd rather have a horse eat a lot of grass hay than a small amount of alfalfa hay.
The other thing that I sometimes wonder too is these supplements, these high calcium supplements that are marketed as being gastric buffers. Do you see benefit in that? Where do you see them falling in terms of the horse's routine?
Yeah, so we have, the marine derived calcium buffers are quite popular. And what we know is this, you know, for something that's very popular, there's very little published research on it. Mm-hmm. When we look at the research that's available, what we see is when we talk about gastric acidity, 4 is the magic number. Below 4, we have sort of damaging acid. Above 4, it's something that, is generally considered tolerable. And so when we look at these buffers, when we give them, we get an increase in gastric acidity from a baseline of maybe 1 to 2, which is an extremely acidic environment. It's nearly sort of basically pure hydrochloric acid, to around about the 4 mark, you know, a little bit give or take 4. And so they're not taking us back to neutral. They're not taking us back to 7. They're increasing it. And so on their own, it's a short-lived effect. It sort of lasts 2 to 4 hours. And then by 4 hours, the effect is largely wearing off. So on their own, they have a limited ability to really impact the total amount of acid and the duration of acid exposure in the stomach. But when I think about gastric disease, I always think about tools in the toolbox. And I think about, you know, not just one magic answer to the problem. And I will use them alongside things like pre-exercise feeding as an addition so that you get a summative effect. You get the benefits from pre-exercise feeding and then a little bit more. And what we definitely see with them is a symptomatic relief. We see that horses, you know, feel better when they get it pre-exercise. And so if we think about, say, refractory disease, like refractory glandular disease, I'll use it a lot for its symptomatic effect. much more than I will use it for its preventative effects per se. We really don't have evidence to support that it prevents gastric disease, but it certainly makes the horses potentially feel better if they have gastric disease.
Right. So they do have a place. It's just knowing how to use them, I guess, effectively and wisely. And so kind of on the same tone, there's so many supplements, at least in North America, that are marketed to gastric health or sometimes even ulcers in particular. Is there any nutraceuticals that, you know, that you have used or that do have some research behind them that owners should maybe consider if they are looking to maybe add something to the horse's diet?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing is to recognize that nutraceuticals are a completely unregulated market. So, you know, we could mix something up in our bathtub and sell it with whatever claim we want. And if we've got a good marketing department, we can do that. And a lot of companies do make claims that they don't really have any foundations for. And so what we're looking for, I think, when we're looking for a supplement, we're looking for is the supplement studied in a relevant population? So I prefer studies that have been performed in clinically occurring disease, naturally occurring disease that has occurred rather than inducing disease. So,
right.
Because I think that's more relevant to the horses mm-hmm. that, you know, are out there in the real world is when you look at naturally occurring ulcers in that multifactorial environment that causes ulcers. The second is studies that have been done and that have had appropriate controls, like a placebo, which is sort of our standard. We can't just give a supplement, say, well, the horse has got better. We know it was the supplement, because often in a multifactorial disease, other changes are made. So we need to have a placebo in there. And it's published. It's got to be published in the peer-reviewed literature. It's not enough that a company says we did a study. It's got to be something that's put out there for external critique and has to stand on its own right scientifically. And then the last point is when we look at that, if we meet those criteria and we're saying, okay, we've got a supplement that meets these criteria, the question is, was it studied in squamous disease or glandular disease or both?
Right.
Because we cannot extrapolate one from the other. So we have a number of supplements that have been studied for squamous disease and have some potential benefit. Very few have been studied for glandular disease. My personal preference is a product called Protect GI in the US and Canada, or hopefully available in Canada soon. And the basis of that is that it's based off some of my research. It's based off an initial randomized placebo-controlled study we did a few years ago, and we've done some follow-up work on that as well. And I should declare for conflict of interest purposes that I do have a financial relationship with Kaleido, who manufacture that, but that's, you know, comes back to the idea that it's based off research that we've done both in squamous and glandular disease in a naturally occurring population.
And so with the research that you've done with some of these nutraceuticals, is it pectin lecithin primarily in that situation that you were investigating?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. So the principal ingredients of that formulation are pectin lecithin and buffer. And I think it's the combination. We have historically, we've had pectin lecithin looked at as a standalone product with variable results. There was a reasonable amount of studies done on pectin lecithin, and we saw some have positive results, and we saw some have no effect at all. And that's probably not unreasonable to expect in a supplement space. You know, I mean, we have to have realistic expectations of a supplement. We know that omeprazole doesn't work in every horse, so how can we expect the supplement to work in every horse?
Right.
But just the pectin lecithin has some benefits, but doesn't seem to be enough in itself. And so when it created that original sort of base formulation, it was the addition of buffering agents. And the principle was we were aiming to create not just a slime to protect the stomach, but to have an alkaline slime to protect the stomach and mimic some of those natural defense mechanisms, particularly the natural defense mechanism of the glandular mucosa, which is this very thin mucobicarbonate layer that separates the acid inside the stomach from the lining of the stomach itself. And so the idea was to try and mimic that. And then the benefit on the squamous is just a direct coating effect. So we're not really trying to change. The principle is to line the stomach and not really around changing intragastric pH like the supplements we talked about before, the marine-derived calciums, which are trying to change intragastric pH, but more to focus on lining the mucosa and protecting the mucosa, because that's where the damage is occurring, and worrying less about what the pH in the actual stomach's doing.
Yeah, no, that's interesting that you brought that one up, because I think maybe in, you know, horse owners might see pectin lectin listed, but they might not know how it works. And then the other one that I see discussed, and I've seen a bit of research too, oils when it comes to ulcers. What is the research there? Is particular corn oil? I always wonder, is it something to do with the fatty acid profile? Is it just because we're reducing starch and sugars, but we're replacing it with fat?
The other thing I'd just say about pectin lecithin is quantity is important. So we will see, and this, we see this with a lot of supplements, is they'll say, well, we've got this ingredient, but there's only this much of it. And when we think about the pectin lecithins and that principle of coating, we're talking about a chamber that's, you know, a 15 to 20 liter chamber. We need to have a significant amount of that ingredient in there to coat. So you'll see a lot of supplements, and it's obviously more convenient to feed a small amount.
Yeah, absolutely.
But when we're trying to coat a large surface, that's not going to work. You know, the mass just doesn't work. So
yeah, doses, yeah, just as important as ingredient, absolutely.
It's not just the ingredients, what's listed on there, it's the amount of the ingredient. And that's where, going back to, you know, when you're talking about the research and that, it's yes, the ingredients and the principles are important. And this also applies to oils. The ingredients and the principles are important, but it's the amount as well. The amount is really important. And therefore, you know, the specific supplement's important, not just necessarily things with the same principles. The oil questions, I guess there's two parts to that. There's the, or three parts. There, does corn oil, for example, reduce gastric acid output? There was some work that suggested it did, and then there was some work that suggested it didn't. So, you know, does it just reduce the amount of acid production? I'm kind of ambivalent on that answer. I don't know that we know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. The next question is, and you alluded to this, is where does corn come in for squamous disease? For me, well, not corn oil, oil in general. And this is, when I say oil in general, I mean plant-derived oil. In general, I use as a substitute for carbohydrates. So we know that carbohydrates, excessive carbohydrates, a little bit of carbohydrates fine, but excessive carbohydrate increases the risk of squamous disease. And so in our horses that have high caloric requirements, replacing some of those carbohydrates with oils, plant-derived oils, is a way of reducing the carbohydrate load while still maintaining the caloric intake into the horse. And that's pretty much, for the plant-derived oils, where I see them sitting. That's pretty much my sort of, you know, my position on them. When we switch over, we then have the other half of the oils, which is the omega-3, omega-6 anti-inflammatory properties. The data we have suggests that, or really is that horses have, when we talk about omega-3 oils, we're talking about long chain versus short chain. Long chain's anti-inflammatory, short chain's not. Mm-hmm. Long chain tends to come from marine-derived sources. Short chain comes from plant-derived sources. Most horses, or horses, have, in general, a very limited ability to convert short chain to long chain. So when we think about people, we think about linseed oil or flax seed oil, feeding that as a plant-derived omega-3 has been shown to not increase the long chain omega-3s in tissues. And so it might, the horse might look shiny and there's other benefits to it, but it's not having an anti-inflammatory effect. So linseed oil or flaxseed oil's days kind of come and gone, because if the horse is deprived of naturally occurring omega-3s, they can convert some across from short chain to long time. So a horse that's dry lotted, for example, can do that, because they're normally, their omega-3s come from green pasture. But a horse that has a normal amount of omega-3s in its diet, short chain and omega-3 diets, is not going to convert that additional plant-derived short chain into anti-inflammatory long chain. So then we come across and say, okay, is there potential benefit to supplementing long chain marine-derived omega-3s? And the answer is, we're working through it. I suspect for glandular disease there will be, and I do use them for some of my complex glandular disease cases. They're probably not the first thing I'll go to, but I think that is a sort of a Pandora's box we're just starting to open. And I think that as we understand, when we start to use, you know, true long chain anti-inflammatory omega-3s, I think we're going to learn a lot more about them and the potential benefits for them, not just for gastric disease, but for things like airway disease and stuff like that as well. But it has to be the right type of omega-3.
Yeah, I think we have a long way to go in terms of our fatty acid research, not only in horses, but in across companion animals as well. So you kind of alluded to when you're discussing glandular disease, you know, you talked about the omega-3s having a place there. What do we do as nutritionists? Because it's happened to me where, you know, someone comes to me and they say, my horse has glandular disease. And then you go and read the literature and you're like, well, you know, looking at the research and what we know about nutrition, we know so much less than squamous. And so is it sort of applying those same principles that we apply to, you know, the prevention of squamous with these horses that have or are prone to glandular disease? Or how do you approach them a bit differently?
From a nutritionist point of view, the answer is yes. I mean, because the things that we've talked about so far, you know, long stem roughage, minimizing carbohydrates, and I'm not talking about removing carbohydrates, I'm just saying reducing carbohydrates, because I think that pendulum maybe swings a bit too far sometimes, and ensuring continual access, and water's the other one, you know, ensuring continual access to water, they're all good for squamous gastric health, they're all good for hindgut health, and they're actually all good for just sort of general horse health. There's the thing that I think that has got lost in the hay discussion, and this is where we get into challenge around managing obesity at the same time as managing gastric disease, is the welfare implications of hay. I think hay is access to forage is one of the fundamental sort of principles of good horse welfare. Absolutely. That is getting lost in modern horse management, where we restricting forage for weight control or other reasons, because probably forage quality, we always go for the high quality forage, where in fact a lot of these horses would do better on low quality. When I say low quality, I don't mean dusty. Mm-hmm. I mean low nutritional quality forage. So all of those things are good for squamous health. Unfortunately, we really don't have any epidemiologically, there's no link to any of those things and glandular disease. It's a little bit of evidence that says that improving those things, particularly things like including alfalfa in the diet and reducing carbohydrates, may be beneficial for glandular disease, but we need to get a little bit more evidence before we get too sort of excited about that. But they're all good things to do. They're good things from a fundamental nutrition point of view, squamous, hindgut health and welfare point of view. So the things that we should be doing anyway. We then switch into how we manage glandular disease, which is more those really focusing on those other aspects of stress and welfare and behavior, which is particularly sort of forage freedom and these types of things. And that's probably where we're coming full circle when we think about glandular disease, is looping it back to thinking about it being a welfare-based disease. And everything we do that's good for welfare is good for gastric disease.
No, that's perfect. And it's...
all the other way around.
It sort of leads to another question that I have. So, you know, you talk about reducing carbohydrate intake, and I feel like when we think about carbohydrates in the horse diet, we're thinking about these concentrates and these grains that we're feeding them. Does pasture become a consideration there? And how do you, again, balance that with welfare?
Yeah, pasture is a great question, because we have this sort of basic idea in our head that a horse out on pasture is living, you know, the perfect life. It's mm-hmm. not. And you know, behaviorally, unquestionably, you know, there's wonderful things to horses being out in pasture, and that principle of freedom is a principle of their basic welfare. From a gastric point of view, we have to think about that not all grass is the same. And when we look epidemiologically, what's really interesting is there's a real divergence of whether pasture is actually protective. So we know that roughage is protective in terms of hay or even haylage, but pasture itself is variably protective. And in fact, is probably there's more studies saying it's not protective than it is protective. And so the question becomes why? And I think the two potential answers are the structure of the pasture and the carbohydrate content of the pasture. So if we think about pasture, we think evolutionarily horses didn't grow up on the type of pasture that we maintain them on our lovely manicured farms with improved pastures. They look great, the grass looks great, but that's not the grass that horses evolutionarily grew up on. They grew up on stalky, stemmy grass, and that's what they sort of adapted to eat. We've trained them to eat sugar. We've trained them to, you know, selectively look for this type of pasture, and that's what we offer them. Because if you have a farm with all this stalky grass and, you know, everyone drives past and frowns at you, that they don't care about their horses because the grass is brown. And, you know, that's just the way it's evolved. And so I think the structure is really important. So when we think about, you know, modern grass is really slushy. And if you chew it up and put it into some water, you basically create grass soup. So instead of taking our hay and chewing it up and putting it in and having this firm ball, this roughage ball, we've now got grass soup, and grass soup will splash around. And so I think, again, that structure. And so things like pre-exercise feeding of long stem roughage, even to horses on pasture, is going to be potentially beneficial because we're going to reinforce that roughage ball. The other is chewing. You know, it's not as, they don't chew as much. They don't need to chew as much to eat grass as they do to eat hay. Chewing is such a critical aspect for natural defense. And then the third one that's probably not talked about that much, but is potentially really important. In the last 20 years, we've had this huge swing away from carbohydrates in their concentrate feeds. And, you know, carbs has become a dirty word in horse feed. And as I said, it's probably swung a little bit too far. But no one's saying, well, how much carbohydrate is in the horse's pasture?
Yeah, absolutely.
If we think about horses consuming, you know, there's a study in New Zealand where they looked at how much does a horse consume grass. It'll consume 40 to 60 kilograms a day of grass. Now, dry matter, that's still about the same. It's still about that 1.5% body weight dry matter, but that can be up to 25% carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. So we would never feed our at-risk squamous horse 25% carbohydrate sweet feed at 1.5, you know, we'd never feed it 7.5 kilograms of sweet feed a day, but we're more than happy to have it out on beautiful, rich ryegrass pasture that might be running at 25% carbohydrate. And so we probably underestimate the potential impact of that carbohydrate load on driving squamous disease, at least in selected populations. And so that doesn't mean we should exclude it, but it just means we should think about what that grass is and then those other mechanisms like pre-exercise feeding around it to mitigate risk if it is a part of the risk, and think about the grass that our horses are on. What is actually good grass for horses? Is it that really rich stuff, or do we let it get a little bit longer? Do we let it get a little bit lower nutritional quality because it's actually better for them, both in terms of their stomach, but also I think their total gastrointestinal health?
You brought up some really good points, like especially when you're, you know, comparing the sugar content in sweet feed to pasture. You're absolutely right. You know, we don't think about that. And I think it is absolutely a really important consideration.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
ICC Animal Nutrition, adding value to nutrition. Trow Nutrition, the science of ingredients, nutrition, and blending. Kemin Nutrisurance is your pet food and rendering partner every step of the way. Trusted ingredients, proven performance. Wilbur Ellis Nutrition, we partner with a purpose. A longer, healthier lifespan for our pets. That is EW Nutrition's target. With immunoglobulins, that target is within reach. IGY are a young generation technology platform. An innovative solution that has been tried and tested over the last decades and can now yield tangible benefits. Immunoglobulins from egg yolk improve the animal's response to pathogens in the gut or in the mouth. They're easy to administer, they're perfectly safe, and they just work. Made with passion, proven with science.
So you've given us so much to think about already, and I think I'm going to have you back to discuss some more things, because I'm sure there's lots of other questions that our listeners would have that I have. But before we let you go, I'm going to have to ask you a couple more fun personal questions. So I'm sure you've done a lot of consults with horse owners whose horses maybe have been diagnosed with ulcers or seem predisposed to ulcers. What's the wackiest home remedy that you've heard that someone's tried in either treating or preventing ulcers in their horse?
Yeah, there's a lot of them around. I have to say that the people that have sort of reached out to me have universally, I would say that the people I talk to that have, you know, come to me, they're 80, 90% on track, and I'm just doing that last little bit of steering, that little bit of nuance in.
Yeah, you're not getting them at ground level.
I'm not getting them at ground level. So we go to Facebook, and, you know, Facebook's the place to go for such wonderful things. And I mean, take your pick, but there was a fantastic one looping around Facebook last week about tobacco.
Okay, interesting. I haven't heard that one.
And I didn't quite touch on gastric disease, but give it time, it will. It was more about parasite control. But tobacco, giving the horses some schnooze, what I thought was a pretty entertaining one. And it was delivered in a very entertaining fashion.
Yeah, no, I haven't heard that one, and I'm glad I haven't, because I don't know how I would respond to that. I don't know that I'd be quite stone-faced when someone told me that they were feeding tobacco to their horse. And so our next question, if you could own any horse, real or fictional, who would it be? Are there any that stand out to you?
I was very lucky to have a horse called Dr. D, who was my polycross horse who I had for 8 or 10 years, and we lost him the start of this year, and he's probably the horse I'd have back. He was just that superstar horse that was really good at what he did, lovely on the ground, and then I could take him, hand him over to one of my, you know, kids, 13-year-old kids, and he would take them around the paddock like a lamb. So, yeah, he'd be the one I'd probably choose to have back.
Oh, that's really sweet. It's, yeah, it's nice when you have horses like that in your life. What breed was he?
He was an Australian stock horse.
Oh, nice. Yeah. No, yeah, we don't get many of those in Canada.
No, it's sort of the Australian version of the quarter horse, but a little bit lighter. But a similar sort of really athletic and, but really sweet, kind temperaments as a rule, and very sensible, I guess, is the other thing we like about them.
Yeah, no, it makes a difference, right? Temperament is, a big one. And then our very last question, if you could give one piece of advice to all horse owners or caretakers when it comes to ulcers, what would it be?
All the things we've talked about, everything we do for good gastric health is good for welfare. And I think that's where we need to shift the conversation. We need to keep talking about gastric health, but we need to move that into that broader conversation about these welfare implications. And so when we talk about hay, when we talk about forage availability, yes, there's gastric benefits, but there's huge welfare benefits. And so that, I think, is would be my take home. And that, I think, is where the conversation goes next. What we do that is good for the gastrointestinal tract is good for the entire horse.
Yeah, I think, as people who love horses and horse owners, think everyone's trying to do right by their horse, right? No one wants to cause their horse harm or they shouldn't. And I think sometimes, we get confused on how to do that in the best manner. But I think you're absolutely right. At the end of the day, it comes down to the horse's welfare and making sure that they're happy and healthy.
Yeah, and having tools to do that, having things that we can actually do. So take the principle and actually say, these are things that we can do that will improve the welfare of the horse. So having those tools in the toolkit, I think, are really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know we just sort of skimmed the surface of this very big topic of equine gastric ulcer syndrome. So thank you so much, Dr. Sykes, for sitting down and sharing some of your wisdom and, of course, your time with our listeners and giving us all something to think about and, I guess, digest. Really, really appreciate it. And maybe if you're open to it, we'd love to have you back and maybe dive a little bit deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for your time. And we'd love to chat again soon.
Perfect. And thank you so much to all our listeners. If you'd like to see Dr. Sykes back again, please let us know. And I'm sure we can convince him to do that.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.